Welcome to our third episode of Ryersonian This Week. I'm Nicole Edwards.
And I'm Tiffany Lam. Welcome back, Nicole.
Thank you, Tiffany.
I'm glad you're back and, you know, on 2 feet.
I am. Well, 1 foot and 2 crutches, but it's not too bad, and I'm super happy to be back on campus. I was going a little bit stir crazy, so glad to be sitting beside you in the studio and not in my closet studio, a la last episode. So what did you get for us this week, Tiffany?
So this week I sat down with a poet and a son of a recently retired foreign correspondent. He actually released his first book of poetry, and the book launch was at Glad Day Bookshop. So I thought, keeping it in the ward this week, I'm proposing this as a sort of kickoff to maybe a new segment we can explore, something like, you know, in case you missed it, something local.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, how about you?
This week, I went down to our sort of neighbors at Victoria and Dundas there at Toronto Public Health and spoke to some people who use The Works, which is the supervised injection site, about how they feel about September 30th being the cutoff for Premier Ford to decide whether or not he wants to continue funding sites like The Works across the province. Stay with us. So this is our last episode before October starts, and we wanted to flag that the Toronto International Festival of Authors is coming up in October. The Toronto Arts Council and the Toronto International Festival of Authors have partnered together to create a 3-year initiative designed to spotlight Toronto writers and empower local artists with career-building opportunities like Toronto Lit Up. And so Tiffany reached out to one of the local authors who was her friend's older brother.
Yeah, a guy who is much, much cooler than me. In high school, full disclosure.
They sat down to chat about his new book, Correspondent. Here it is.
Well, hi. Thanks for having me. My name is Dominique Bernier-Cormier, and my first book of poetry just came out. We had the launch yesterday. It's called Correspondent.
And I noticed that you called it documentary poetry or lyric journalism. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so I guess there's two reasons why it feels reductive to just call it a book of poetry and not mention journalism at all. The first is because these are poems that are about historical events, and I wanted to bring sort of a journalistic standard to the telling of those stories, and so make sure everything was factual and sort of properly told. So it is, I consider it kind of a work of journalism, a work of nonfiction, but told in sort of lyric prose. The second reason is because it's also a book about journalism. It's a book that talks about my father's work as a correspondent. And I like the word, lyric journalism because I had heard about, I knew those stories. The book is about three historical events that my dad covered as a correspondent. The sinking of the Kursk, the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, and the theater hostage crisis in Moscow. And I had read extensively about those stories, but always in very sort of dry political terms. And to me, there was something, some of the lyricism was missing from the telling of those stories. And so I was trying to tell them and have the thrust of those stories be the images rather than the narrative of it. So that's sort of what I mean by lyric journalism.
The thing that was very striking to me reading the book was the detail, like some of the details that you created from 3 different lenses, right? Like it seems like you were in it as a child, your father was in it as a correspondent, but then somehow you also had the person that it was happening to. Like, how did you reconstruct those details?
A lot of reading, a lot of research. I really made a point of inventing as little as possible, of really keeping the details historical. So it was a lot of reading firsthand accounts of what had happened.
Did you interview your dad at all?
I did, yeah. My dad was involved from the very beginning. He was a great resource because he had covered all those stories, and so I could check with him And sometimes I would write something and send it to him, and I'd be so proud of it. I was like, oh, this is such good poetry. And he would tell me, nope, that's not how it happened. You have to go back and rewrite it. And I would say, but it's such a good detail. It's such a beautiful poetic detail. And he was, no, he kept me honest with the historicity of the events.
Why did you choose these three events? I know you said it's like the dryness of it, but why did you think it was important to tell it in your book and, you know, in 2018?
Yeah, that's a question that I thought very hard about. And I think a question that you should ask yourself when you're starting to write about stories that aren't necessarily your own. And those three stories are stories that I had a personal connection to. So the sinking of the Kursk happened right when we were about to move to Moscow. And it was the first story my dad covered in Russia. And he actually had to leave. We were supposed to move at the end of August. This happened mid-August. And so he had to leave early to cover the story. And it was really the first, my first connection to Russia, the first story I heard about Russia through my dad. So that was the sort of the beginning of the adventure in Russia. And then the story of Masud is one that my father actually, I think, got very affected by and would always talk to us about. And it became a sort of folklore for our family. They felt like they were, they're public events, but they felt like they were also personal family stories that we would tell. And then the hostage crisis in Moscow, my little brother had a classmate who was held hostage and managed to escape. So I chose stories that felt very personal.
That's interesting, because also we were talking about that in a class recently. You know, how much distance should a journalist have from the story they're telling?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is your stance on that, given that you just said you chose it because it was personal?
Well, I should make clear that I'm not a journalist. And so that having the title of poet, I think, affords you, allows you to be a bit closer to your subject. I always said that I wasn't writing about Russia, about the course, that I wasn't writing about Afghanistan, but what I was writing about was my connection to those stories. And so I think that's a distinction that I want to make, because those stories were told through a few different filters, the filter of my dad, the filter of memory, it's been 15 years, the filter of language. I experienced all those things in French and wrote about them in English, and so I think the fact that those filters are there sort of stops me from saying that I was only writing about those events. What I wanted to write was my connection to those events.
Right, the lyric in the lyric journal.
Yeah, and so I don't...
So check out his book. It's a quick read. It's journalistic, in my opinion. And I really do think it has an interesting layout to it. Sometimes the text will start at the top corner and be punctuated with like real quotes from people who were at the events that he's talking about. That alone, I think, was really compelling. So,
Toronto Lit Up book release parties take place all year long at Harbourfront Center and other venues across the city, like our local gem, the Glad Day Bookstore.
Next week, Premier Doug Ford decides whether or not to pull provincial funding from supervised injection sites across the province. There's one right down the street from campus, or rather on the same street at the corner of Victoria and Dundas. Our editor, Nicole, looked into how service users and city officials are feeling about the sites and the potential reallocation of funds.
And Mr. Ford, you're up first.
Well, my friend, what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to have injection sites in neighborhoods. I've talked to numerous people that family members have had addictions, and they're telling me they don't want an area that they can do more drugs.
At the corner of Victoria and Dundas, there's usually a crowd of people outside the Toronto Public Health Building. It's where you'll find the Works, one of the city's supervised injection sites. For the past few years in Ontario, opioid overdoses have been one of the province's most deadly public health issues. In the year between August 2017 and August 2018, paramedics received 695 calls about suspected opioid overdoses. And that's just the number from the neighborhood around Ryerson, Church Street, Yonge Street, Moss Park. Across the city, there were hundreds more. So from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., people who use drugs can use them under supervision. They can use them in a place where if something goes wrong, there are medical professionals and volunteers on site to look after them. And because people can get clean needles there for free, the spread of HIV and Hep C is less likely too. Some of the city's safe injection sites have found permanent homes, but for other sites, funding from the provincial government runs out on September 30th. At that point, it's up to Premier Doug Ford to decide whether the province will continue to give them funding. These sites opened in the first place because of special permissions given to the province by the federal government. For 6 months, the province was essentially allowed to do what it had to do to intercede in a quickly mounting death toll. 303 Torontonians in 2017 alone died by overdose. That's a 63% jump from the year before. And standing outside the Works on Victoria Street, it's hard to imagine these sites aren't needed anymore. It's where I met Kimberly Monk, who said her mother goes to the Works.
Yes, my mother. She's overdosed a couple times here, but she's all right now.
Kimberly told me she thinks the supervised injection sites save lives, and that she'd way rather her mother use on site there than anywhere else. She said that she believes safe injection sites keep people safe. The chair of the Board of Health, that's the board that governs Toronto Public Health, agrees with Kimberly. His name is Joe Mahavik. He's a city councillor too, and he had a big role in opening the supervised injection sites in 2017. He's concerned that Premier Ford doesn't understand what's at stake here.
Now, he has said beforehand that he really wants to focus on support so that people get off of drugs, of rehabilitation in particular. And that's great. But, you know, you got to keep the person alive long enough to get them in that direction.
And while we haven't heard exactly what advice Ontario's health minister gave to Premier Ford on what to do with the injection sites, Councillor Mahavik says there's little dispute within the medical community that safe injection sites prevent deaths. He says the overwhelming response supports a harm reduction approach to helping people who use drugs. The supervised prevention sites are one of those harm reduction methods.
A harm reduction approach to drug use does take some thinking through, especially if you've been schooled in a more policing approach to drugs. So if you see someone in a laneway, historically, almost the instinct was to say, let's phone the police. Now we're evolving in the direction of saying, no, let's make sure that the person is taken care of and let's call a healthcare professional so that they can attend to that person in a more helpful manner.
People in Toronto may have a better picture than they think of what happens if safe injection sites lose their funding. The very first site in Moss Park a few years ago was started by the community. The feeling then was that city officials were moving too slowly, that they were too disconnected from what was happening on the ground, and that people were dying while they were making decisions behind closed doors. And the death toll was rising fast, so up went makeshift camps.
There's a community of caregivers that includes doctors, nurses, social workers, healthcare professionals that are really committed to the drug-using community and preserving their lives. So what I suspect you're going to see, frankly, is a more confrontational approach, an in-your-face, well, you're not going to allow it, we're going to continue it, and we're going to continue it here. If you want to shut us down, then shut us down, but we'll be ready, and then you'll have all that conflict that really is totally, totally unnecessary.
And Kimberly, who you met before at the Works, she's not about to let safe injection sites slip through her fingers either.
I'd rather an injection site, way better.
You think they keep people safe?
Yes.
What would you do if the one that was closest to you ended up closing?
I would try and make my own new one.
This story was produced by Nicole Edwards with help from Ryan Moore.
This week, you heard stories from Tiffany Lamb and me, Nicole Edwards, with help from Ryan Moore. You can let me know what you thought of the show on Twitter. I'm at @Nick_416.
And you can find me on Twitter at TLMSY. We're also at Ryersonian. Thanks for joining us and see you next week. Here's the final word, Dominique Bernier-Cormier, reading a little bit from his first book.
I think I'm just going to read from the beginning of the book. And so the first three sections are from the three lenses, my lens, my father's lens, and the historical lens. And this is from the poem about the Kursk. A red bulb drips from a ceiling of steel. Dmitri reaches for a pencil in the pocket of his ironed shirt. He tests the sharp tip of lead, traces a line in his palm. Oxygen drains from the thick air, like breathing in bricks, a church at night full of smoke. Dmitri flattens the wrinkles out of a loose sheet. Water leaks onto the paper from the escape hatch, a chandelier of seawater. His wrist moves in the dark. His name, Lieutenant Captain Dmitri Kolesnikov. The time and date, 1:15, August 12th, 2000. Pins and needles in his arm from breathing in carbon monoxide, like being tattooed by air itself. Still, his Russian flows in calm waves, steady strokes. The zeros floating above the line like hopeful silver bubbles. At our seaside cottage in New Brunswick, my mother teaches us difficult strokes, butterfly, Cyrillic. My palms learn new ways to hold pens and waves. I point Moscow out to my brother on a deflated beach globe. I already know the words water, broken, and why. I write pages and pages of M's, waves that never crash, frozen. We storm the beach, waving sharp sticks, pretend to be Napoleon soldiers crossing the Moskva. I wear a dead jellyfish as a crown, a cape of algae. Behind a bay window, my mother packs boxes, wraps glasses in thousands of little bubbles. She writes books, fragile, personal, in black marker, in a language she can't read yet. My father sits on a flowered couch in St. Petersburg, a notebook open in his lap. Irina Kolesnikova slides her son's wedding tape into the TV's mouth. From the corner of his eye, my father can see Dmitri's empty room. Dumbbells resting on the floor, little wrecks. On the TV screen, a dove bursts from cupped palms. They watch in silence until the tape clicks to black. Roman Kolesnikov brings out a silver tray with glasses and a bottle of cognac. Tanya, my father's interpreter, translates three toasts. The Kolesnikovs hold a photo of their son for the camera, their hands shaking. Outside, young men with shaved heads snap branches of silver fir. They brush the snow off a bronze plaque, pass a flask around. Before each swig, they read his name aloud.